A very scary episode this week, Blenders, as we discuss the new Scream trailer, we review Halloween Kills, and director David Gordon Green joins the show.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome, welcome to episode number 186 of Real Blend, the podcast with the Colgate commercial smile and Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch enthusiasm, baby. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and on this week's show, boy, did we miss our box office predictions for No Time to Die. Halloween Kills is going to hit theaters. And director David Gordon Green, director of both Halloween and its sequel, is our guest on the show. He's going to be joining us a little bit later. And by us, I mean Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin. How are you, sir?
Jonathan, Gabriel, Jacob. Also David Gordon Green of Pineapple Express fame, might I add, which is a great film of his. Yes, very
he's
excited
through
about this conversation.
He's gone through a couple of stages in his career. Yeah. Indie director...
He's almost like an Adam McKay, kind of.
He is a little bit like an Adam McKay. Oh, he's another guy I'd like to get on the show later on for his DiCaprio.
Netflix, if you're listening.
Yeah, please have him on.
Don't Look Up. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Looks a little strange, right? That trailer looks a little bit strange.
I'm all in.
It's a great premise.
The Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch enthusiasm, man, is Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago, and also... the subject of a fantastic Forbes profile.
That's right.
That talks about Jake's illustrious career. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
It's a weird day. I'm doing great though.
Congratulations on that piece, man.
Thank
that piece
you.
Is fantastic.
There's a huge chunk of that piece dedicated to our little show.
There is. Yes, that is also very cool. And truthfully, you know, you have really great stories to tell from your entire career. The Tom Hanks story is great. And Tom Dore gets mentioned, which is great. But then, you know, to come back around to Quentin and the show and all that stuff, it's
if you are a loyal listener to this show, I don't think there will be any stories in the article that are unfamiliar to you.
Right. Yeah. But you did get Larry Crown mentioned, and that's what I'm
Larry Crown.
It's all that matters.
Lawrence J. Crown.
Anyone looking for that story, I'll drop it in the description.
So. Oh, that's Gabe Kovach. That's Gabe Kovach, the producer of Real Blend.
Also worthy of applause.
Hello, Gabriel. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Thanks for joining us. Head down and give us a like and a subscribe while you're here so you can come back and listen to all of our episodes and interviews. For audio listeners, if you want to watch us as we get all fancied up, camera ready, head to youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Of course, we're available all the different places you can get your podcast needs met. Hey, have you signed up for Real Blend Premium? On Real Blend Premium, you can get an ad-free version of the show, an extra segment every single week that we drop on Mondays, usually when we're playing a fun game, and then a newsletter that I write every other week, and it arrives on Fridays, as does the show. We now have a Friday drop date for the show. So if you want to learn more about Premium, go to cinemablend.com/RealBlendPremium. Let's start the show. Let's get in with the weekly poll. Jake, I'm throwing it to you as our horror expert.
Yes.
We asked the people, who is your favorite slasher? Before I even give the choices, Jake, why don't you tell me who your favorite slasher is?
It's Freddy. It's always been Freddy Krueger. I think a huge part of that is Robert Englund's performance.
Sure.
You know, a lot of these, outside of Tony Todd as Candyman, a lot of these slashers have been played by multiple people, and they're less tethered to... a personality and a performance. And there's just something about Robert Englund's performance that I think is so attached to the character itself. And also the idea of not being able to escape a slasher in reality that, that he chases after you, I think is horrifying.
That is pretty scary. Kev, yeah. Do you have a favorite?
I mean, the Freddy one is, it's just that concept of not being able to fall asleep. I don't think there's anything more terrifying than that. I mean, I really don't. I'm just kind of echoing Jake in the sense that like Freddy is the ultimate because, oh. I mean, yeah. And Sean,
I'm so Sean, jealous.
Sean is showing a Chucky doll for people who are listening. Just
my little buddy,
just
my little
audio.
Buddy doll.
Just my, on audio.
Is that still what he's called? Was he called My Little Buddy?
Look at his hair. I know this is more for the YouTube, but his hair is crazy. And then he's not scarred. Like, he looks like a normal little boy here. Like a sweet little boy. Sweet little boy.
Please, Gabe, have that be the thumbnail of this.
We have passed him around our house. So many times. So as soon as Chucky arrived, Brandon put him in PJ's bed. Charles. Put him in PJ's bed.
Yeah, without the scar, his name is Charles.
His Charles. And,
and then
look at his face.
Then
so
PJ
happy.
Put him in Michelle's bed on Michelle's side of the bed. Then Michelle leaned him against Brendan's door so that when Brendan opened his bedroom door, Chucky fell in. Then they put him in my chair here, so when I walked into my office and I turned my light on, he scared the daylights out of me. And then finally, Brendan put him in PJ's laundry basket, so that when PJ opened up his closet, Chucky was staring back out at him. So we've had a lot of fun with Chucky over the past couple of days. I'll put him down now. But yeah, it's weird.
I want to say one more thing just in terms of the slasher question about the poll. I also think Freddy might have the greatest... And this sounds really weird because I don't like using this terminology because I feel like we've gotten to a culture now where horror movies are celebrating the kills. Like Michael Myers is like that's kind of where we are in horror. That's fine. That's just the way entertainment went. But I think the one that out of all of them that has the most memorable kill is the Johnny Depp death in The First Nightmare.
That's a good
because
one.
I will never forget. Well, the concept of not being able to fall asleep to me is already terrifying, and then being helpless in that sense. Like at least with like Jason and Michael Myers and those characters, like, you can run. You have a chance. Yeah. When you're sleeping, you have no chance.
Yeah.
But I'll just never forget that the image of the body in going into the bed and then the blood shooting up.
Yeah.
I remember I was interviewing Johnny Depp for this movie called Transcendence, and I got to geek out with him a little bit about Wes Craven and kind of that particular shot. And just like that scene alone to me solidifies Freddy. And I also want to shout out Freddy vs. Jason, which is an underrated, awesome movie. It's a little cop out or at the end with who dies and who doesn't. But
such a cop out. It's a great premise though. Like the reason that they came up with to have both of them exist in the same movie is a great idea.
But I'm going to argue Freddy wins. And
because he winks at the camera?
Right. So, Jason cuts Freddy's head off, right?
Yes. And then Freddy winks at the camera.
So Jason technically wins the movie. He wins the fight. He wins the duel. I have no problem giving that to Jason.
The last one?
Wasn't that always considered... When I watched that, I always thought that of as like, oh, this was round one of Freddy versus
round
Jason.
One.
Goes to whenever I spoke to Bruce Campbell, because there were those rumors for a while that there was going to be Freddy versus Jason versus Ash.
Mm.
And whenever he was approached about it, apparently he was told by the studio, like, heads up, like, Ash can't hurt Jason in this way, he can't hurt Freddy in that way, he can't do this, he can't do that, which is a little
like Vin Diesel.
Yeah, it's just like Vin Diesel and Jason Statham in The Rock. Like, it's a little frustrating to know that, like, it boils down to, like, contractually who can get hurt.
Sure.
And we're not going based on story. Like, that takes a little bit of the fun out of it.
Can I ask you a question, just because of the poll? This is going to sound... To a horror person like Jake, this might sound like a stupid question. Do you consider Michael Myers to be a human being?
No.
I
not anymore.
He's not, right? Because he's
I go based on how he was created. I don't go based on how other people have taken him. So to me, he's more terrifying if you think of him as a human being.
Okay, but what is he now? Because okay, I get he was born a human. We know what he does in the beginning of the opening of the movie. But I was talking to my anchors about this yesterday because we were airing my Jamie Lee Curtis interview, and they were like, "Is Michael Myers human?" And I'm like, I mean, is it possible that there was some supernatural element that came into the play?
I don't think, not in the sense I don't like these movies anymore, but like I don't think about that as much. Like I think about it how John Carpenter created him, and that's to me that's how it is.
Okay. There's also there's stuff in Kills that kind of addresses that, and I don't want to get into it because it's a little spoilery. There's at least lines of dialogue. So I would go Jason. If I'm picking my favorite, if only because I think that as the series kept going, like it got comically, you know, exaggerated about the different ways that they could kill him. And so I kind of, you know, the one point they stab him in the grave and then the thing gets hit by lightning and it brings him back to life.
That's great. I love it. I love that. Awesome. Yeah, is that where Corey Haim is there?
No, it's after Corey Haim. Cause Corey Haim's the one. Oh, it's Feldman. Corey Feldman.
Feldman. Sorry.
Kills him in 4.
Yeah.
And then I think he gets resurrected by that lightning bolt.
But I want to say Feldman's there when he comes back out of the grave.
He's not. It might be his character. It's his character, but it's not Corey Feldman playing him, though. But it is his character, Tommy, I think.
Tommy, yeah.
All right, so the poll, Michael Myers won by a long shot.
He's kind of considered the king, right?
57%. Yes. I would probably say Freddy in this poll.
I'm surprised he's the OG. You beat Freddy.
Freddy got 26%.
Freddy hasn't been in a movie... A good movie.
Oh,
that's a really good point.
Fair.
Gabe hit the nail on the head. That is exactly what it is. Everybody who is voting on that poll, there's a recency aspect. Michael Myers has been ingrained in our minds, at least now, for the past 3 or 4 years, just because of the resurgence of that character.
Personally, I would still pick Myers, even without the recent movies.
Yeah. Really?
But that's just how I grew up. What I grew up on.
Candyman, Pinhead, Chucky.
Pinhead, Chucky.
Ghostface.
Ghostface is probably...
When you say Ghostface, what does that mean?
Ghostface is number 2 for me. One?
Just but Ghostface is multiple people.
Yeah, is it Billy? Is it Stu? Is it Timothy Oliphant?
That's the cool, unique thing about Ghostface.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Ghostface is the only one, because Michael Myers, Freddy, all those guys, they're theoretically the same being or individual.
The person with the poofy coat in Urban Legend?
One thing I will say... To go to Gabe's side for 1 second, because we are jumping into a Halloween interview, so actually this will be a good transition. I do believe that Michael Myers has the most terrifying aspect. Aside from what Freddy can do, there's this thing that Michael Myers does that to me is so iconic to the character. It's a simple head tilt that he does when he's like examining his kill, and it's like a... It's so psychologically messed up on
doesn't,
so many...
Ghostface do that once, right?
I think he might, like, as an homage...
Ghostface is so badass. Scream is so cool.
Oh, my God.
Ghostface is cool.
The fact that Kevin Williamson wrote the opening scene of Scream in, like, a day is insane.
We're going to get to some talking points after our interview, because we have David Gordon Green here talking about Halloween Kills. So let's get right to that interview. Without further ado... David Gordon Green discussing Halloween Kills on Roblox.
All right, man. So I'm going to start out talking about shooting those scenes set in 1978, because there were moments where I kind of paused. They looked so much like the original film that I paused and went, wait, is this a scene I don't remember from the original? And then there was a moment where I went, wait, was this in Halloween 2 and I just don't remember it? Like, that's how good they looked. So I was just wondering how you pulled something like that off.
Well, you know, it was just a combination between an amazing art department that did meticulous research and studied the original structures, the original Myers house, and every detail from the film obsessively. And then our camera department, Mike Simmons and his crew, that, you know, Mike talked to Dean Cundey about lighting and the color and atmosphere and when to move the camera, when not to move the camera, kind of following in the methodology that Dean and John Carpenter established for us. So obviously we're there to pay homage to a classic film and want to do it as authentically as we can.
David, I really want to speak to you about the ending of your first Halloween film. Cause we don't get a chance to talk to you about endings when you come around on the press tour, essentially. But when I got to the end of that film, I really thought, like, damn, they did it. They figured out a way to actually trap him in a way that he's not going to get out. So I would love to hear what your process was when it came back around and you were like, oh, now we got to figure out how to get him out. When you left him there, did you know, or did you and Danny basically look at each other like, oh, shit, all right, I guess we got to figure this out.
That's funny you say that, because with every great idea becomes an obstacle is how to get out of that great idea. And so I thought the same thing you did when we came up with those ideas, and some of those were the fine tuning that McBride brought to us at the kind of in our last draft of that script of ways to tighten the ratchet and really make it an airtight ending for Michael, because that's what you would want. That's the only thing that you're not going to roll your eyes at. And then how do you get him out of there? So as every fan is probably wondering from the second they hear that there's going to be a sequel, we are too. So we scratched our heads and came up with what we thought was the most fun, really retracing the steps and found looking for any loopholes in Laurie's plan. So that's a fun conundrum.
You know, speaking of a fun conundrum, you guys do something really interesting in that you craft a horror movie in which Laurie and Michael never really share a scene together, which I thought was really fascinating. I was wondering at what point, as you're crafting the story and you're realizing where each of these two characters are, at what point did you realize, hey, we're just going to keep them apart for this movie and then presumably bring them together for the finale?
Yeah, and it was a lot of talking to John Carpenter about it. It was a lot of the same things that they struggled with when they were making the original Halloween 2, you know, is how do you keep them alive? How do you keep that cat and mouse dynamic, that that relationship? It's so specific that it's almost romantic. You know, you look at a movie like Silence of the Lambs, and there's just that intimate connection between your hero and your villain, and we have that in this. And so how do you do that? And so we found ourselves leaning more and more and using a film that we'd kind of dismissed in our original concept as Halloween 2 is not a part of our narrative and our part of our chronology. But there were amazing seeds from it that we were able to take and utilize and then take our own path and try to make it satisfying at the same time. So it's expanding the universe by expanding Haddonfield and visiting characters that are legacy characters or characters that we've set up in our 2018 version and then exploring where they go. Meanwhile, as an emotional anchor, you don't ever want to get too far away from Laurie Strode. But if you're going to tell a story in the same night, man, she's been stabbed in the guts, and she ain't doing a whole lot of dancing. So you have to kind of figure out where the leaps that you can take are. And I was just talking to Jamie a little bit ago about the logic police and when you call them in to call bullshit on what you're creating, and when you just say, you know what, we're all gonna have a good time. We're gonna take a few leaps on this one, but let's roll with it.
David, I want to touch on a concept of fighting back, which I think was a pretty decent theme in your first one that really gets elevated in this second one, because the Laurie that we meet in your first Halloween obviously has been sort of planning and training for it. And here now we get to meet a lot of the old victims of Michael Myers, and they don't cower. You know, they're very quick to say, like, the mantra of evil dies tonight becomes pretty prevalent in it. So I'm curious as to what was really interesting to you about that dynamic, because it's not something that you see in a lot of horror sequels. It's quite often it's people who are running away from the bad guy, and in this one your people are really running at him.
Yeah, so that's just part of what we're studying in this film, is not necessarily just the cat and mouse in its traditional slasher formula, but how that expands, how fear shows up in other forms, and miscommunication and mob mentality and someone's interpretation of how to respond to something that's stressful or horrific is different than the other person. So the juxtaposition of their reactions, who wants to lead the charge and who does want to cower away and have a rational perspective. So, you know, between Tommy and Karen and the various voices trying to argue their way into a rationale here, that's part of what the conflict that we explore beyond just the obvious of a guy with a knife is trying to do bad things.
You know, David, I'm a big fan of these films. I grew up on the 70s and 80s and 90s slasher films, so much so that obviously because of that, it means inherently I'm a fan of Nick Castle. And there is a scene in which, I don't think I'm giving it because it's teased in the trailer, in which Michael is unmasked. And I was wondering if that is Nick Castle, and just to, I don't know if you have a TV monitor there, but I'm enough of a fan that I've got a Nick Castle signed mask there. And I was just wondering, is that Nick Castle reprising the role of Michael again after 40 plus years?
Well, first of all, just to kind of alleviate any concerns the audience would have, is this is not a, we don't want to see Michael Myers. We don't want to see any expression, any emotion. There's no revealing of any identity of him, but in these moments that where there is a maskless Michael, it is it was important for me to keep the physicality of James Jude Courtney's performance to just keep that continuity there. So Nick was there on our very first day of filming. He's there as a script consultant. He has a cameo in a scene that you'll see in behind the scenes and deleted scenes that where he does put the mask on yet again. But in terms of the actual performance of the 2018 era Michael Myers, it is James Courtney. And then there's a 1978 flashback where Aaron Armstrong is in the suit, and he was our stunt coordinator and tried to emulate some of what Castle and his physicality of that time period suggested a little bit of an evolution there.
Fast. He was so fast in that flashback. I couldn't believe how quick Michael was moving. I was like, oh, that's right. The shape used to move really quickly like that. David, I don't know if you actually thought about this, but you've now technically directed more Halloween films than John Carpenter has. So I don't know. Are you at a point where you feel some ownership over the characters, over the property, or do you always feel like you're playing with someone else's toys?
That's a great question, and I have to say I'm honored to be playing with someone else's toys, and it's fun to have my own signature in there. And I think when we're flashing back in the time period, it's my duty to do as much as I can to kind of emulate a signature of John's. But then in the mythology that we're playing on, expanding on, and toying with, it's just exciting to have a collaborator like John. He actually keeps me in check. Honestly, it's. He's not just a godfather in essence on the movie. He's someone whose notes I take very seriously, from the script to the edits. His music is an incredible essential element of the design of the atmosphere and these characters. So I have to say that this is just a childhood dream come true as a kid that grew up being haunted by this movie and inspired by his work. In the body of work entirely, from Big Trouble to They Live to Fog and The Thing, like so many of his movies were monumental to me, to actually get to respectfully walk into his toy chest and say, let's play, is pretty fun.
Well, and we were having this conversation right before we joined with you about, did he ever reveal to you why he never directed any of the sequels? Was it just because he was on this magnificent run in the 80s of totally original projects?
I don't know. That'd be a good question for him. I've never asked him. But now I'm thinking about it. What sequels has he done?
I don't think any, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and until this one, I had never done any. I kind of had an aversion to it. We toyed with a Pineapple Express sequel, but never got off the ground. So
Did he do Escape from L.A.?
Oh, or is that someone else? I think he
good one.
He
yeah,
did.
Of course.
Yes, he did. Good call.
I don't know that I do know that this in part of his mind was going to become an anthology, which is where Season of the Witch comes from, and which is a film I really enjoy. But then went back to the Michael Myers saga, and that's where the franchise really has lived for the last few decades. And to me, it's just important to have his voice. A major contributor to what we're doing.
For sure. David, I can't imagine anyone gets to the end of this film and isn't immediately looking forward to Halloween Ends. And you know, we're kind of in this era now where we're looking for, you know, a conclusion. You know, we're about to get it with Bond, and I think, you know, obviously we're going to get it with Michael pretty soon. Once that happens, should there never be another Halloween again, or is it up to another filmmaker to try to figure out how to sort of reinvent the wheel over again? Like, you know, how do you not make more Michael Myers movies down the road?
That's funny to even think about, because like I'm certainly no authority of culture, and at this point Michael Myers has become movie monster mythology. Mm-hmm. And so just as much as we'll see Wolfman's for eternity, I have a feeling that our legacy Leatherfaces and Myers and Freddies, these guys are gonna come back in new forms and face the world in new ways and tell the bedtime story to more children. I think it will for me personally, as I age and maybe get cranky and roll my eyes or laugh along with it, I think it's going to be exciting to see what happens to the legacy of Laurie Strode and Michael Myers.
To that end, am I right to know that you're in pre-production on an Exorcist sequel? Is that still happening?
That's happening. Yes, I'm very excited about that.
Can you talk just a little bit about like lessons you've learned from doing this with Halloween? You don't have to get into specifics, but maybe just how you approach a classic property and sort of reinvent it.
I approach horror movies with love, you know, because there's so much of my life and in conversations and education that they don't get a lot of the respect. And I feel like culture is now at a point where there is that appreciation for that, the communal experience of what horror brings to us, to community, the horror community. And so, I don't know, I feel in some ways like it's going to happen. And I just want to make sure it's not done disrespectfully of the originators of that. So there's certainly a compelling argument for why wouldn't a filmmaker want to tell a unique and individual story to himself. I look at it in a way as like I kind of am triggering and channeling, communicating with myself at 11 years old when I was exposed to these movies. And so many of the projects that I've worked on my entire career from my first film onward are triggering that era of my life between, I'd say, 11 years old and 15 years old, where I'm discovering movies for the first time. I'm connecting with my own internal emotions for the first time, whether it be The Boogeyman or The Blues Brothers. These are things that come out in other ways. And I use my work as my therapy, I gotta say. And so it's fun to connect with that kid that was so excited and optimistic and yet vulnerable. And now I get to... I get to tell my demons what to do a little bit, and I like that.
That's awesome. That's a great quote.
I love that. I was just going to say that's a great line. I'm a big Paul Rudd fan, and I know that the Halloween in which he is a part of is not a part of this timeline. But I also heard that there was at least an attempt to try to get him back potentially to play a role in this film. And I was just kind of wondering the details of what happened there.
Oh, that's right. So Paul and I did a movie several years ago. That I hope everyone in the world sees, called Prince Avalanche. And it was just an amazing experience. It was me and Paul and Emil Hirsch in the woods for 15 days shooting a very low-budget movie. And it was just such a blast. And it's just refreshing when you see the mountain of material that it takes to make a movie. This was not that. This was just stripped it all down. And so we became good buds after that. And I reached out to him when this kicked in, thinking, like, it's too crazy of an opportunity not to at least see where he's at. And lucky for him, he was in the ring with Reitman doing Ghostbusters, which another childhood dream come true. And so it didn't work out timing wise, but it's just fun to get his consultation. And I got to let Anthony Michael Hall know that he got the thumbs up from Rudd. So there's a fun, as much as there's a horror community and a community of fans, as I've gotten involved in this franchise, there's just great legacy characters and faces and voices that have come through the franchise, and you meet them at Halloween conventions and you get to geek out and get their autograph. And that's so cool. And some occasions, like with Paul, I get to become their buddy and keep them as a voice in my life and work is kind of special.
That's outstanding. Love that. David, we love to talk about specifics in terms of filmmaking, and I won't reveal any details about this character. But there was there's a moment in the first movie, because we're jaded and cynical, you know, critics sitting there, nothing really shocks us. But there's a moment in your first Halloween when Michael's walking through a house and you put in ADR of a baby crying, that I actually sat up and I was like, no, 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 do not do this. And you top it in this movie with a character falling from a very from a height toward the pavement. I won't go any further than that, but you do some elements to it to put us in the driver's seat of that fall. And I wonder if you can maybe just talk a little bit about the technicality of pulling that shot off, because I really felt like I was with that person.
Yeah, well, that's great. It's a combination of old school stunts, jumping out a window of a building, which is amazing, and they don't do very often anymore. So it's cool to be a part of that. where my friend Jeff from New York got to jump out of a window onto, you know, as you see it. And that it's a very cool thing to stage and go through those safety protocols. It's a dropping, putting a camera perspective in the right place, using visual effects to add hands and motion to make it really feel alive, like you're in that character's point of view. And it's the choreography of the swan dive from actors and camera that makes it all is, and then add a splash of Christopher Nelson, our makeup artist's abstract brush there at the end, just to put a little kiss of elegance on it.
Yes. Oh, I love it.
It was gruesome.
I love it. Dave, I have another very nerdy question for you, because when both your last Halloween film and this one started, the thing that made me go, ah, was that you nailed the font, the title card font from the original film. It's like, it's not super crisp HD. It's got a little trail off the orange into the black. And I just wonder how difficult it was to find just that exact font so that it looks like it came from 1978. It makes me audibly gasp every time I see it.
Right. And there's something specific. It's not just the details of the font itself, but it's the way that it kind of bleeds an imperfect yellow orange. It's like almost like a loose register. And that's our friends at Cutting Edge and our production designer that literally, from the pumpkins that we film practically to the font and its animated quality, there's trying to again, do the Carpenter film justice. And I think that's something that we take very seriously to put into our own films, and then try to make something that's identifiable of each chapter. So if the first one was a little bit more of a singular jack-o'-lantern experience, this one is, as we called the movie in production, we called it Mob Rules, because it kind of was about that gathering of excitement in a community. And so we have all of those pumpkins are practically the blend of pyrotechnics and some subtle animations, tears of blood, and some fun things along the way that were added and embellished in our title sequence. So that's really fun. And now I'm literally yesterday I was talking to our designers about how we take it to the next level on the third film.
Ah, all right. We have time for one more before we have to wrap up. But I'm curious if you were able to shoot any stuff during this production that you know you could save. Were there things that you just grabbed because you had people in the moment, or did you really just focus on everything for Halloween Kills?
Not really. The third one, we switch gears a bit, and so it's a jump in the future, and it's a little bit of a changing of tune there. So chapter two was just, it's letting it all loose, and it is. Hopefully a very satisfying middle chapter that shows the calamity and chaos of a town that's turned upside down by Michael Myers. And then we take a beat, we jump in time, and we figure out a intimate way to resolve the madness.
Oh, interesting. David, I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I just want to thank you so much for bringing filming back to North Carolina. We're super proud of the work that you've done here. And I hope you continue to bring work back here and that you find the right resources that you need here. So thank you.
Right on. Thank you, man.
Yeah. And we're out of time. Continued success with this franchise. And thanks for coming on Real Blend. We really appreciate it.
Good talking to you guys.
We want to thank Universal for giving us time with David Gordon Green. The movie will be on Peacock and in theaters starting on Friday. We're going to give our review a little bit later on in the show.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's get to talking points. Real quick, we want to go over the Scream trailer. Obviously, we're recording this earlier in the week, so hopefully everyone has had a chance to see it by now.
Scream.
How do you Scream. I'm going to call it Scream 5. I mean, from here on out. And, you know, it's just like, it's very much like Halloween Kills, which you just saw. It's bringing back the OGs and putting them in a movie that advances the mythology, just like Ghostbusters is going to do soon. And, you know, the new trailer looked fine. Nothing really grabbed me in it. It looks like another Scream movie. I'm not sure they're doing anything extremely clever with it just yet, but it was an early tease. Jake, you might have seen something.
No, I believe that they're, I believe that, to use a overused cliche, that that trailer is the tip of the iceberg. I think there is going to end up being a lot of things going on that they have not put in that trailer yet. I would not be surprised if there are entire plot points that we don't even know. I refuse to believe that they got Arquette, Courtney Cox, and Neve Campbell back by just doing a, hey, we're doing another slasher. Like another I think there has to be a hook that they're not ready to reveal yet. So the basicness of the trailer doesn't concern me. That's if fair. The movie ends up like that, then I'll be concerned, but I don't think the movie's going
to
be like that.
Before I throw it to Kev, I want to add one thing. We did get to do a set visit for Scream 5.
Ooh, wait, did you guys go to the house? The Woods
no, no, no.
House?
It was virtual. No, it was virtual. Oh. And we they didn't show us a whole heck of a lot. And we talked to only the young cast. We didn't get any of the originals. But the weird thing about it was, even though you're completely embargoed,
probably because
it was
you
a
refer
set
to
visit,
them as the old cast.
Yes. They couldn't give any plot details. They would not give us any plot details, even though when you do a set visit, you're embargoed out the wazoo and you can't run anything until they tell you you can run it. The only thing they talked about was how much they love the original franchise. So, Kev, you weren't that blown away.
No, I mean, to be 100% honest with you, I don't need another Scream movie. It's not like I'm clamoring for one. I think they're going to have to go big on this one. And I think in terms of what Jake was saying, I think that I think in terms of a killer here, this has got to be a big deal. And I think it's going to end up being someone like a Courtney Cox or like a David Arquette, like one of the OGs has gotten so fed up with the history of it. And like the Hello
as
Sydney.
As long as it's not Sydney.
Well, yeah. Well, no, but the killer literally says, Hello Sydney. Yeah. It's an honor.
I love that
but
line.
See, like, it's funny to me because, like, I bring this up, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. There's a, right before they get to the Good Will Hunting 2 hunting season scene, they jump through a Wes Craven set where Wes Craven's filming a Scream movie.
Don't forget, they're also in Scream 3.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. They're filming a Scream movie and the killer is a monkey. and you know, it's Kevin Smith.
Damn
but,
it,
like,
Wes!
But what's funny about that is what's also kind of the problem now is that, like, that joke was made in 99 or whatever. Sure. And it's like, okay, all right, we've seen, like, you know, who's the killer going to be? That's the whole bit now. So I actually, Scream 1 and 2 are great. I don't love 3 and 4. 4 I thought was better than 3, weirdly enough.
4 is better than 3. No, 3 is known to be the worst.
3 is bad whenever you realize, and once I read this, I was like, oh my God, it changed the movie for me, that Neve Campbell contractually only gave them, like, 8 days for the movie. And then when you see the movie, you go, oh my God, she's barely in it. Now, she's scattered throughout to give you the illusion that she's in it a lot, but she is barely in that movie.
That's funny.
That sounds like Halloween Kills to me a little bit.
That very well could be. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's get to our... So, okay, we made box office projections at the end of last week's episode.
So right. Oh, did we?
All of us were so correct. I was celebrating all weekend.
I'm amazed
how
that we
right
were all able to be right at the same time.
Can you retroactively go back to the last episode and edit that out?
I'm sorry. I was doing Kevin's prediction minus my prediction. That's how I was doing the math.
That was kind of what it was.
Prediction was a I gave was just a doubled version doubling of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
and mine, I don't know if I said this during the show, but I said international divided by 3.
So we were all right. Welcome.
We were all correct.
No wonder you all listen to this show.
No Time to Die, we all had it in the 90 to 100.
I'll give you what you guys. I'll give
you. There's no need. That's okay.
That's okay. Wait. Give the real number.
I'm going to rap Gabe. I'm going to rap Gabe.
Wait, are we allowed to do that?
It did 55.2 million domestically.
Sure.
But as Jake wisely pointed out to all of us, it did well. I thought it did over 300 internationally.
313. So 313 is the worldwide total.
Oh, I see. 259 with another, yes, and 313 million worldwide.
And Bond's an international franchise, anyways. Like for sure. if you look at Skyfall, like that's the 1.1 billion of that movie. 800 mm-hmm. million of it is international.
100%.
800 million. So
yeah,
but this still did open lower than Skyfall and Spectre because of the older crowd, I think.
So it came in at 55.2 million domestic, and you guys guessed.
Oh boy.
Let's see. Jake guessed 90 to 95 million, which was conservative at the time.
So are you saying I won?
No, Jeopardy rules. You all lost.
Wait, no, that's Price is Right rules.
Price is Right rules.
What did I say? Jeopardy?
Jeopardy.
Jeopardy.
Okay. You're still wrong. 110 million is what Sean said.
And I didn't phrase it in the form of a question either.
Yeah. Kevin said 125 million.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's
to Kevin's
swing.
Credit, Kevin did say, yeah.
He said this is maybe crazy. This is a crazy he did say
so,
that.
And he was right about that.
I think he thought he was over by like maybe 25, not 75.
So let's very quickly go around the horn and just discuss why we think it underperformed. Because I mean, I don't think it's wrong to say it underperformed. 55.2 is not a number they were happy with. I am going to, I know the length is an option. I know that maybe bond fatigue is an option. I'm going to chalk it up to really just, oh God, I don't know what I'm going to chalk it up to, because the Venom number means people do feel comfortable going back.
Right.
So I guess it has to be length. Like a 90-minute movie can zip through, but a 2.5-hour movie takes longer time. All right, Kev, you disagree.
It's not length. It's older crowd skewed.
Okay.
And I'll tell you exactly why. So look at every movie that has done well at the box office in this time period.
Sure.
Venom 2, who does that skew to? What's that general
teenagers
age? Probably 13
teen,
to
early 20, yeah,
30,
early 20s.
Right, okay. Free Guy, who does that skew to?
Probably teens and 20s, yeah.
Right? Who does Shang-Chi
Marvel's Marvel. Yeah, Marvel is Marvel, I think.
Okay, but Shang-Chi's probably still a little younger on the age.
I think so.
So I'm going to use my parents as an example, because every single movie I've mentioned, and Jake, by the way, you're muted, just a heads up. Every movie I've mentioned, Shang-Chi, Free Guy, and Venom 2, all crushed at the box office. And again, they're all younger skewing films. My mom and dad are vaccinated and still do not feel comfortable going to the theaters. So Bond, and I'm not saying your Bond is an older, I mean, Bond, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's
Bond
older.
Does, it is. It skews older.
Definitely
it does.
Older.
It just sure. Definitely does.
It's an adult franchise.
Right. So I think
my teenage kids don't care a damn about, they don't
right.
know.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So what's fascinating is, if you think about it, Bond and like the Mission franchise, like these films that we think are going to open massively, I feel like they seem to underperform, and in this case particularly, because the older crowds aren't ready to go back yet, or they're just ready for it to come out at home, which scares me about Dune, because I don't know where Dune skews in terms of like age. But I really do believe this was an age thing. I don't think the length had anything to do with it. I really believe that, like, my mom and dad were like, Kevin, I want to see James Bond, but I'm not going to the theater to see it. So it's like that, how many people were like my parents? So, you know, I'm interested to see what happens with Dune, because Dune's a weird one.
Jake, what do you think?
I was just going to ask you guys, do you think it has legs? I think week two is going to be a huge determining factor of, now, look, I don't think there's any conversation about whether or not it's a success. You look at the worldwide numbers, and yes, it is a successful film. And so the domestic numbers, it's not even, you know, I mean, it's not even like a quote-unquote American film. It's not an American character. It belongs to, you know, another country. So we are just another country in which this film is playing. So it doesn't really matter whether it does $300 million or $200 million here.
I want to argue that if they really wanted to go for a big opening number, like Marvel loves a big opening number. Yeah. Fast and Furious wants a big opening number.
Yeah.
Bond didn't play into the marketing campaign of, there's a ton of spoilers, be the first one in the conversation. Yeah. You know, they did talk
they
about
did,
Craig's
they,
last
they
one.
Did say, they did play into, like, this is the end.
Legacy, yeah.
For sure, Craig's last one.
But guys, this is the key here. This is exactly what happened. All right. Listen, this is interesting to me. I know it's Marvel, but Shang-Chi did $75 million opening weekend.
Yeah.
Unknown character, unknown star.
Yep.
And I know the Marvel brand is consistent, but that's still a massive number.
It's a huge number.
James Bond is such a much a bigger character in pop culture than Shang-Chi
sure.
is.
Absolutely.
So like all the kids who went out to see Shang-Chi, that's what Bond was missing. They're missing that younger enthusiasm, because the younger people are the ones who want to get out. I was doing a live shot the other day at a high school, and they were telling me that their stands where the students stand and watch the football games are doubled than what they ever used to be before the pandemic, because younger kids have been so pent up and home.
Oh yeah,
that's why Venom did 90 million. It's a fun 90-minute like PG-13 comic book film.
Sure.
But I am surprised. But you do know this is the fourth highest opening Bond of all time, though.
But not adjusted for inflation.
Inflation.
Like it's like Spectre is significantly higher. Quantum is significantly higher. It's
all right. Well, we'll check and see what week two looks like and if the movie in fact does have legs. But we want to emphasize again that over 300 million, you know, out the gate is makes it a success. It's just interesting to see how films are playing. More so to apply that reaction or that knowledge to movies that are coming down the pipe, things like Eternals,
honestly,
things
if,
like
if Dune opens poorly in the States but grosses $500 million worldwide, that sequel's getting relit. Greenlit. Sure.
Now, Eternals is long, so that's going to be interesting.
It'll be a factor. And talk about not knowing anybody. I mean, the cast, yes, but not those characters.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to learn a lot about some interesting DC projects in the next couple of days. We're recording it earlier in the week. You guys will hear this starting on Friday. And as of Saturday, Warner Brothers is unveiling a lot of information for some anticipated projects at DC Fandome, the second of these events that are taking place. The first one was actually really exciting. I was thinking about this earlier in the day. That's when we got to see the Snyder Cut trailer for the very first time.
Wow, my God, has it been that long?
Yeah, that's when it was. Snyder dropped the full Zack Snyder's Justice League trailer during Fandom at that event, which is really strange, too, because that was the first event that teased The Flash, where they talked about Michael Keaton coming back, and now we're going into Fandom and they're still going to be talking about The Flash because everything's been pushed back. We expect to see Jason Momoa potentially giving some information about Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. There's a Shazam movie that they've been filming. Obviously, Dwayne The Rock Johnson is going to be coming by with Black Adam. And I know that we're anticipating seeing a second full trailer for Matt Reeves's The Batman. I'm excited to see that. I think we've seen a decent amount of that. If I had to pick the one thing out of Fandom that I'm most looking forward to, and I want to let you guys know that if you're listening to this episode after Fandom has happened, obviously we're going to have a ton of content on Cinema Blend's main page and, of course, our YouTube channels, and the guys will be talking about different things on their socials. I want to see Keaton as Batman. Like, I really do want to see. Yeah, I do think we're going to get a shot. Like, one quick shot.
I just got chills just thinking
about it. Do we see him as Batman or as Bruce Wayne?
Oh, that's a good question.
I think you'll see him as Batman. I do.
Ooh. Well, I
do think we're going to see him as Batman.
But this goes back to the conversation we had a few weeks ago about whether or not you wanted to see Garfield and Maguire in the No Way Home trailer. And I wonder why you feel different about that because we know Keaton's. Well, I guess the difference is that we know Keaton's in the movie.
That's the difference.
But we all know Maguire and Garfield are in the movie too. It's
we
just
don't
know. Confirm.
Do
yes,
we
don't
though.
Do.
I don't.
We do.
I don't.
We do.
He's the werewolf.
but I will say, like, I mean, in this instance, like, he's already gone on talk shows, told everybody that he loved wearing the suit again, and you know
that's why you can show it.
That's why you can show it. That and all honesty,
there's a
like,
great interview on YouTube where he talks about it. If you'd like to watch,
this is true. And he also and if you think about it, like that's the money shot. Now, I will say this though:
they're going to give it away this far?
Does that take it away from Pattinson though?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, that's a great point.
That is a good point.
I would say they should have considered that, you know, before they decided this is how they wanted to treat their universe.
Well, are they opening near each other? They are. They're opening like October, November next year.
No. The Batman is March, isn't it? Or do they push it back again?
I'll double check.
I don't know. All right.
It's going to be Pattinson focused. Well, I will say, and I got to say, the trailer they released with the Nirvana, Michael Giacchino.
March 4th.
Oh, that's good.
But that trailer we got for the Batman with Pattinson and like the Nirvana track with Giacchino. By the way, if you never heard our Giacchino, Michael Giacchino interview on Real Blend, he breaks down kind of how that came together, where his music combined with Nirvana's song. It's interesting. Like, yeah, do you put Keaton there because I mean, what's everyone going to talk about? Keaton.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know. I think the fandom, itself is. I think they'll enjoy both enough. I don't think they have too much to worry. Batman's Batman.
It is a glut of Batman content, though.
Sure, but like they always have Batman comics, Batman animated stuff. There's Batman video game stuff. Batman's always doing something because he is
so
Batman.
The Flash movie, I don't know if you guys have been keeping up to the date on all of this, but in addition to having Michael Keaton, Ben Affleck is in it, playing his version of Batman. They cast that girl as there's a Supergirl in it. There's a rumor going through that Fiora, I believe her name is, the one who was a Kryptonian who fought next to Zod, she got banished into the negative zone with Christopher Maloney, I believe the actor's name is, when they were fighting on the ship, and then the ship goes through the deal, and she's rumored to be in this as well too. Like, she's gonna emerge from not the negative zone, the Phantom Zone. Negative Zone is Fantastic Four. So there's gonna be a ton of characters that are gonna be in this, yeah. And poor Ezra Miller, he's like, isn't this my movie kind of thing? But
and then for some reason I did hear that the end of the Batman trailer is going to be Nolan saying, "I'm Batman," but in Bale's voice. Like, they're gonna cut to Nolan.
Or he's just gonna do the Michael Jordan thing and just say, I'm back.
It's just gonna cut to Nolan. I'm Batman.
What if Nolan is wearing hockey pads?
Dude. You're talking about like dream stuff. Could you imagine if
I'm back to hating this podcast.
If ever got like a photo of Nolan playing hockey and then like did a meme about it, I mean, that would be the greatest thing I've ever seen.
That's not true, because we did see the greatest thing that Kevin's ever seen, and he hasn't heard it yet. But as at the Directors Guild,
don't even get me started.
Christopher Nolan moderated a Q&A with Denis Villeneuve.
Have
you listened to it yet?
No, I tried looking for it. And like, so Chris Nolan, for people who aren't aware of this, this is really cool. He's obviously such a fan of the stuff we are that he goes to these DGA things and just interviews his heroes. Like,
our jobs, Nolan.
He did one, I think he did one with Michael Mann, Pacino, and De Niro for Heat. I think he did one with either Spielberg or something. It's unbelievable. It's so cool that he does it. And this Denis one, so I'll give a little tease for next week for our interview with Denis Villeneuve. He geeks out about Tenet, which is really, really cool. So for people out there who are waiting for that interview, Denis obviously a big Nolan fan, and he's using a lot of Nolan's a huge inspiration for him. So it was cool to hear him talk about that. But yeah.
Here's my favorite bit about that. Kevin shared the photo, I believe, of the two of them together. And Jake's first response was, I wonder if they mentioned us.
What do the two of them have in common? They've both been on Real Blend.
They both.
What else would there be to talk about?
But Denis was like, I haven't been on yet. They didn't run my episode. They haven't run it yet.
All I'm saying is, I've only been in Forbes one time, but 100% of my Forbes articles mentioned Real Blend.
What if Denis was like, did you listen to the premium?
Oh, God. That is not a French Canadian accent. What
was terrible.
That was
awful.
Horrible.
I know.
Well, he'll never come on. He's not coming on for part two.
Oh, they made me scream Dunkirk at the end.
Oh, my God. What is happening?
I don't do impressions. Arnold.
Which, ironically, you didn't do that accent when you said, I'll be book.
Oh, I should have, right?
That's greatest joke in the history of this podcast.
That's pretty good.
Let's get to this week in movies. We have two big films that are going to be opening up, both on the big screen, one exclusively, and one also coming to the mega streaming service of Peacock. Poor David Gordon Green when he got told that. Let's start with The Last Duel.
I thought that was a joke. That's really happening?
Halloween Kills is going to be on Peacock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Peacock.
Yes. The name bothers me.
Yeah. Oh, everything about it's terrible.
But to be fair, the name HBO Max used to bother me. Now I just rattle it off like it's nothing.
HBO Max sounds fine. Halloween Kills Peacock. Opening on Peacock sounds strange. It just sounds a little strange to me.
Terrible. And he said in a, he did a Q&A this past weekend and said that the main reason he was okay with it going to streaming service, and then we'll get to a review in a second, is because he knew that like Halloween Ends is getting into production and they had to get through that story and he just wants people to be able to see it. Like it was so refreshing to hear a director be like, I'm tired of my movie getting pushed back.
Yeah.
You know, like get it in front of the audience.
And he doesn't need this movie to do well for it's going to do well, but he doesn't need this to do massive numbers.
This film is just a middle. Yeah.
I want to get to The Last Duel. So this is Ridley Scott's film, set during medieval time, and tells the story of a sexual assault that is told from three different perspectives. And it's in a unique chapter structure where you get the perspectives of first Matt Damon's character, then Adam Driver's character, and finally Jodie Comer's character. And I just went into this because we were joking on some of the episodes that Ridley wasn't doing press for Last Duel and he was saving it for Gucci. And we were like, oh, maybe because Last Duel isn't that good. And then watching it, I was floored by how good it was. And we're going to acknowledge right off the bat that it's extremely uncomfortable. Like, the subject matter is very difficult. It doesn't shy away from how uncomfortable the situation of the sexual assault is. And the fact that it is like grotesquely dated in its thought process in terms of the balance of power, both in gender relations and politics at the time. Like, there's an elite class and there are the peasants, there's the haves and the have nots. And this movie leans very heavily into it. And it almost feels like there are things that happen in the movie that are so shocking in the way that they're imbalanced that you sort of reel and you say, like, oh my God, how can they? And then you're like, oh, okay, it's right. It's a medieval movie. That's probably how it was, but it doesn't necessarily buffer the impact of some of the horrific things that happen in this movie. But part of the reason why I said that it is as fantastic as it is really the craft and the structure of it. Like, I mean, obviously I'm not breaking news to tell you that Ridley Scott's a fantastic filmmaker.
He's talented.
But the script is amazing. It's written by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. And then Nicole Holofcener.
You call him Sir, by the way.
Sir Ben Affleck?
Sir Ridley Scott.
Sir Ridley Scott. Oh. Yes, that's fair enough.
You've referenced him three times. Yeah, yeah, not be a fourth.
Sorry. Inside joke if you've seen the movie. Yeah.
The third chapter is written. I thought this was an incredibly smart decision. They brought in Nicole Holofcener to write the perspective from Jodie Comer's character. And Matt Damon was telling us that, or maybe he was telling one of you two, I'm blanking out where I saw it, but like, oh, as Ben Affleck said, like, I can tell you how her contributions changed it, because the way we would have done it, you know, would have been one-sided and relatively, not bad, but, you know, just not nearly as graceful as it was the way that she handled it. Jodie Comer, I know we were raving about her for Free Guy, for how good she was in Free Guy. She's incredible in this film and has a really, really difficult part to play, not just because, you know, but the subtleties of the way that the story is told in each of the different chapters are not minuscule, but you really have to be paying attention to how different character motivations shift and move. Hers in particular changes from one chapter to the next. And by the time you finally get to hers, it's outstanding. It's long, but it never lost my interest. And, you know, some of the period-specific battles, including the duel itself, not giving it away, but there's a duel in it, are phenomenally filmed. So I highly, highly recommend this, and I think you guys agree. Kev, you're with me on this?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, people look at the film and you see Ridley Scott and you see some of the scope of it, and if you're looking for gladiator-style filmmaking out in terms of, like, scale and action outside of the tragedy of the story itself, it's there. I mean, this is the guy who directed Gladiator, and it feels like it. I mean, it's orchestrated battle sequences that are just incredibly well designed. What's interesting about it is that's just part of the movie. Jodie Comer, my wife, I want to give my wife Lauren credit, has been on the Jodie Comer train for years now with Killing Eve. And so when Free Guy came around, she's like, "You're my God, you're interviewing Jodie Comer." I'm like, "I don't really know who she is. I'm excited about Ryan Reynolds." But like, and then you see Free Guy and you're like, "Oh my God, she's an amazing actor."
Yeah.
But she is absolutely incredible in the role. The brilliance of the perspectives, the Kurosawa aspect. I know that that Affleck and Damon have kind of said that wasn't exactly what they were going for, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's Rashomon. It's a tragedy that happened, and it's three different perspectives. But the brilliance of the movie is having the actors do little nuanced things differently in the same scene. So and I asked the cast if they just shot all of those perspectives on the same day versus resetting back up, and that's what they did. They would show, all right, here's Damon's perspective, let's shoot it this way, boom, cut, now let's go back here, all right, Jody, you're gonna smile this way this time versus the way you smile
here.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that they talked about, was because, like, in the movie, and I'll give this is a great example. So, like, for example, there's a scene in the film, this is not a spoiler, but there's a scene in the film where, like, Jody's character smiles at Adam Driver. Hmm. But from Driver's perspective, that smile is something different, right? And then from her perspective, it means something completely different. Wow. And the little nuances of that, they would set up the day, they would shoot it, and then they would say, all right, now we're in Jody's perspective, so just switch it, do it this way. And you don't realize how powerful a subtlety like that really is in terms of, like, a storytelling tool. I walked out of this film when it ended and the publicist comes over and I was like, what I just watched was incredible, but I don't know that I enjoyed it. Like, you know, like, how do you tell someone that this is an enjoyable film? But at the same time, it is one of the best stories about a hero that I've ever heard. I didn't know anything about Marguerite and what she was up against. I mean, you have to understand, at this time period, as Sean mentioned, not only was she sexually assaulted and had to come forward with it, she also had to have her husband's approval to even take it to the court systems.
Sure.
Like, you couldn't even, like, I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, it's unreal.
The language they use, which is a grotesque but true, was that it wasn't a, I forget exactly how they say it, but they say it wasn't like a personal affront. It was an issue of property, and that she was her husband's property. Yes. And he had to sue because of an abuse to his property, which is like,
there's
examples throughout it that are very, like, very punch you in the gut examples of that. But there are even subtle ones that he uses, like when it opens and there's like a court jester or someone who's like introducing the duel. And he says, like, gentlemen, knights and noblemen. And he never even mentions ladies or anything like that. And it's like, there are these subtle cues of where he's really trying to hit home of just how different the levels they are placed in society. And it's brilliant the way he does
it. And there's a line in the film, again, and this is a true story, but, like, the reason why the character is such a hero is because of what she stood up against. And to give a perspective, actually, to come forward and help women like that, is incredible, because there's this line that's said about, like, I'm gonna paraphrase it, about, like, a woman essentially, like, actually I won't get into it because it maybe deals with a spoiler about something that happens in the story, so okay. I'll save it, but fair. it's a line about what a woman should do then from another woman's perspective, like, oh no, you should do this to protect this. But your want to be heard is not as important as this, which is what this character is basically saying to her.
You know what line really struck me as weird though, Kev?
What?
When Ben Affleck looked at the camera and he said, I don't know, Duel, what are we gonna do?
Oh yeah,
Duel.
Jay and Silent Bob's right. No, but the movie is great.
Affleck is great in it too, by the way.
Affleck's great. Damon disappears.
Yeah.
And I saw someone on Twitter say this, and then we'll get to Jake. Nothing Ben Affleck does in this movie should work.
Yes,
I don't understand. At first, because his character's a little jokey in a weird way, and like at first I'm like, wait, what's going on here? And I'm like, but wait, why is this working? Like, why is this weirdly working? And so that's something I thought was really interesting, that, like, that they went there with that. There's a weird comical aspect to some.
I want
to
go back and watch it just for Affleck, to be honest with you.
He's so
good. I kind of want to just go back and see his parts.
It's a really good character. Shout out to Driver too.
Yeah.
Because I don't think everyone's going to talk about Comer, which they should.
She should, but right, for me, she's got the win for my money.
She should win Best Actress right now. Done. Over. We haven't seen Spencer yet. Driver in those scenes, though, that is some mean stuff, and I don't know how he went there. And that dude like, I don't think he's going to be talked about that because he is the quote unquote villain of the story.
Also, but I think we've just come to expect things like that from him. Like, we just expect him to be good. He's, and it's he's a little very bit unfair. Powerful.
That's
and
a, also, too, I also think people have the ability to separate an actor from an, like, from the sure, character. That, like, I don't think anyone's going to, like, as great as Adam Driver is in this movie, I don't think anyone's going to look at that and, like, have it change their perception of.
Yeah.
It's a dirty character. It's a really mean...
Yeah, but a lot of great actors have amazing histories of playing dirty characters. It doesn't necessarily. Yeah.
Jakey, do you like it as much as we do?
I absolutely love this film. One of the things that I thought was interesting whenever I was speaking with Ben and Matt and Nicole, and they were talking about the challenges that Nicole had in particular with writing this film, is that Ben and Matt had a lot of records to go through to base their characters' perceptions on and the other male characters' perception on, because at that time, the only people who were really allowed to keep records and put pen to paper were men. There are no first, not really that many first count perspectives from a woman at the time. So for Nicole to be given a huge chunk of the film and arguably the most important chunk of the film to be told from a perspective of which there are no records told from, is really, she had the most, like, you know, uphill battle. Gabe and I saw it the same night, and he and I were texting back and forth, and what's horrifying about this, and yes, look, this took place literally hundreds of years ago. And
14th century.
But there aren't that many changes I think you would need to make to the story to set it in 2021 and basically tell the same story. I think we're still... In a world where we're fighting to make sure that women are believed, and I think we're still fighting in a world where, you know, women aren't able to say what they have a right to say about themselves, and, you know, it's as wild as it is to hear a lot of the things that you guys mentioned about, you know, things, you know, whether someone was considered a piece of property or they weren't addressed whenever the duel was announced. There are a lot of things where you go, yeah, 14th century shit hasn't changed that much. And that's, to me, that was one of the most striking things walking out of that movie. In the same way that, you know, to obviously in a completely different world, you take Shakespeare and put it in high school. There are a lot of aspects of Last Duel that you could put in 2021 and you wouldn't be that different of a movie. And to me, that is one of the most horrifying things about the film, and one of the things that Ridley does best. About both separating the worlds and bringing them together, but for me, yeah, it's a technical marvel of a film, and I am honestly, it's a movie. Sometimes I'll really like a movie, and then as the days pass, maybe I didn't like that as much as I did. I really liked it walking out, and I think with every day that passes, I think I love it more.
It's excellent. Give it a chance. See it in a theater. It's not an easy watch, but I think that people need to learn her story. I actually feel honored through cinema that I now know her story, because like it's such an important story to hear, and what this woman did or what Marguerite did was just incredible and amazing.
All right, so that opens in theaters exclusively. You'll have the option to go to theaters or potentially watch Halloween Kills on streaming. And Jake, I'm gonna start with you because you again are resident Halloween guy, our resident horror guy. How did you feel about David Gordon Green, guest of the show? About his chapter, his sequel in the trilogy that he's putting together.
I was fairly disappointed in it, if I'm going to be honest with you. There are a lot of things on paper that I should have loved, you know, bringing back original characters from the original film, obviously has worked for me when it comes to other films in the past. This film felt insignificant. It felt like, just to get us from A to C. I don't think this is a massive spoiler, and Gabe, if it is, go ahead and cut it out. But, like, a Halloween film exists in which Jamie Lee Curtis does not meet up with Michael.
Mm-hmm. You're okay.
And that just astounds me. And I guess logistically, you know, as David said, I guess, like, logistically it makes sense, but, like, I didn't particularly care about really any of the other characters. And so it got to a point where it felt long. As brutal as it was by like halfway through, it committed the worst sin of all, as it just sort of felt boring. And it got to the point where, like, with every character that was killed off, something that should be horrifying me, I just kind of thought, well, there's one left to go. Like, one less that we have to get through to get to the, like, I just sort of felt like if I were to ever rewatch these films again, I would just do Halloween and then in theory, hopefully, Halloween ends.
Yeah, you don't know yet.
This film did very little for me. I will say, there is, without getting into spoilers, there's one scene that I loved that may have been my favorite scene in the entire movie that Kevin hated, which I find fascinating. Without giving it away, it is Michael trying to decide just what the right knife is. And I loved that. I thought that was wickedly funny. I thought it gave me a little twinge of like into his psyche, just how much of like a weird perfectionist he might be about his kills. There's something about the thought of this Goldilocks and the Three Bears atmosphere feeling of Michael Myers going, that's not the right knife. That's not the right knife. That's not the right knife. That I thought.
Does he have an Australian accent in your head when he says
that? No, that's a knife. I thought that was brilliant.
We're not
Kevin,
doing
I thought
accents
that was
on the show.
Yeah, that's right.
Kevin, I thought it was interesting that scene in particular was the one that bothered you the most. And that was for me, one of the few saving graces of this entire film.
There's a reason why that scene, and it's funny because you and I had different perspectives on that scene as to what was going on. And
sure.
I was viewing it not the way you were viewing it. I was viewing it from the other perspective, which we won't go into.
Sure.
This film is completely unnecessary. So here's, and I said this on the podcast when the 2018 film came out. You got rid of every sequel. You bookend Halloween 78 and 2018. Your movies are both called Halloween. Like, you have this phenomenal moment where three generations of Strodes are in a moment where they can kill Michael Myers. From a story perspective, that's brilliant. Like the overarching idea, 40 plus years later, three generations, it took three incredible women to kill this psycho killer, right?
I agree with you 100%. Yeah. The ending of Halloween 2018 is, it's the right ending for the franchise.
Thank you. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're driving off and now this one, we know Michael's back. Like, at the end of the day, I understand we live in a world where movies are business. I get it. I understand it. I get the business that we are in. But for me, my immersion's taken away when I know, when it feels like business. This feels like a business movie. This does not feel like a story pushing forward. It's a buffer film for some type of finale we may get. The assumption is that she'll meet up with Michael again and eventually actually kill him. That's what we're all, I guess.
It's called ends, for God's sakes.
Ends, right. So, that being said, the script... Now, one thing I will give these movies credit for, and I told Jamie Lee Curtis this, which I think is interesting. In a horror film like this, or a slasher film, the kills are, like, it's become a thing. But they do handle mental health and grief well in these movies, and kind of like the in just in terms of what this would do to somebody so many decades later, and then their family. They did it really well on the first one. I thought the first one was more, 2018 was like was a mental health movie about kind of like the about what it did generationally. So there are moments in this film that I think are interesting. It's nothing to do with Myers. It's more of her character and dealing with like some of the older characters that return. But overall, the script, the dialogue, I love Anthony Michael Hall, but he's not good in the movie. It's a bad performance, just bad.
Is it, or was it, I couldn't decide if it was him or the
dialogue.
Script, because there's a lot of lines, I felt like he was giving it his all, but when 80% of your lines are evil dies tonight, I mean, you can only say that so many different ways.
Well, I just found myself watching this movie, and it just felt so meaningless. I get that everyone's excited for a Halloween film, but I also don't think we should be in a society where we're celebrating Michael Myers killing people. It's like in the sense of like this is a movie where Michael Myers is the star, and you are being entertained by his kills.
I think that's a bridge too far. I haven't seen the film, but I think that's a bridge too far. I think it's a horror movie. I think there are plenty of people that have good fun seeing about how a movie can elevate the scares, can elevate the kills.
I would agree with Gabe on that.
It's like saying that Grand Theft Auto is the reason that, you know, kids are violent. Like, I just disagree with that. I think that's a weird... I think that's a mixed match sort of... reasoning.
I don't know. But
I understand
me,
that it's not your cup of tea. That's totally fair. But I think it's a bridge too far to say that it has no place in our world.
I mean, you were talking about how cool it was to see Johnny Depp sucked into the bed and the blood coming out of it.
Right. But see, to me, back then, even with the 78 Halloween, what, five people die in that film, and now the death counts are doubled and tripled. And I'm not saying, listen, I get where we are. Listen, I was first in line to see Saw when I was in college because I couldn't wait to see what the heck they were going to do with this. And then, of course, you get addicted to this stuff. It's like that becomes the entertainment value. The kills in the 2018 film, I felt, were more substance and story related. And the kills in this one just feel like a game
to
play.
That's 30 years of horror sequels, though. Like,
well, let me,
I get it.
Like,
yeah.
Let me add a different perspective. Because I think that these movies should be made for an audience who doesn't care about the stories of the characters. We were talking earlier about the teenagers are the ones who are coming out to the movie theater, right?
Sure.
So I watched this movie first in preparation for the junket. And I was on the same page with you guys. I thought it was... I understand what they're trying to say about... I was really disappointed that the three main lead female characters who were so important to the first movie are completely sidelined in this movie. Like, there's just nothing for them to do. They're largely in a hospital, and they're every once in a while talking about what happened the night before, but it's the baton has been passed to all these townsfolk who, like you guys, I didn't invest in, I didn't care who they were. The night after I watched it in preparation for the junket, my PJ wanted to watch it with a bunch of his friends, and my screener link still worked, and so I said, sure, throw it on the TV downstairs. And they loved it, because they don't care about the backstory of who Laurie Strode is. And they
tell people
care.
What they were doing during it, though.
Oh, well, they're teenagers.
Come on, be honest.
They were talking to each other.
They were texting,
but that's how teenagers watch movies.
To be fair, teenagers
nowadays.
Do that in a movie theater, so it's not.
This is how they watch movies nowadays. They are not as invested in backstory or motivation the way that we have conversations on this show about things that we think are really important in movies. I think that there's still a place for. And I'm not even saying that Halloween Kills is a good example of one, but there's absolutely a place for a better made. Movie where it's just sometimes scary. You know, some of the characters are broadly written and comically so. There's a couple in this movie too, where when you meet them, you're like, oh, you're easily going to be, fodder for the killer coming. But it's sad to me that it's being positioned in the middle of a trilogy that could have been really special, I think.
Yeah.
But so far right now has one really good movie and one that hasn't necessarily worked just yet. So
I feel about these movies kind of how I feel about the Jurassic Park films, which is like a majority of them that come out, like I don't like them by the time I see them, but I'm still going to get freaking jacked when a new one comes out because I want to show up and I want to see whether it be Michael Myers or dinosaurs rip into people. I'm there for it every time. And even if I'm disappointed walking out, I still just want the spectacle of it happening in front of my eyeballs. And even though I didn't like Halloween Kills, bet your ass I'll be there for Halloween Ends. And even though I didn't like Fallen Kingdom, you bet your ass I'll be there for Dominion. Like, it's just a matter of like just seeing it again, just literally seeing it. I just want to see.
Well,
it.
That's kind of what these studios are betting on with all these franchises, right?
Yeah, right.
Like the ones that aren't maybe as meticulous as Marvel are going like, yeah, we don't really need it to be good. We just need it to be exciting.
Yeah. We need it to exist.
Give me Malignant, over another Halloween
movie.
Because at least it's trying something different.
Yeah, but and I think that's something the industry has always battled with. Like,
for sure.
I think they've always battled with of what's the big commercial thing that we can flash in front of people's eyes that they're familiar with versus the exciting new thing that might have a chance to be one of those down the line.
To Gabe's point, though, I mean, yes, I will say as I get older, there's something about unnecessary violence that is started to strike me differently in a different way, because I was one of those people who would go to those movies as I mentioned, but like for example, I just finished watching Squid Game on Netflix.
I'm only through the first episode. It's good.
So, well, all right. I'm not gonna get into anything, but
sure.
Talking about violence and the way violence is used in a story. Mm. That show is so brutal that after episode 6, I had to stop and like give myself a break. But the difference between Squid Game and Halloween Kills, and the deaths in Squid Game are way more brutal, way more violent, way more people die, is that there was substance, good characters, good story, and that's why I kept watching it. It didn't feel like I was unnecessarily watching people die for no reason.
Sure, sure, sure.
So when I'm watching the Halloween Kills film, I'm just like, he's walking into someone's house. I'm like, it just emotionally doesn't, I need something there for that. I will say this, and this is the last thing I'll say on this, and then we'll move on to the blend game and the review. There's a scene in this movie, in Halloween Kills, that is amazing. All I'll tell you is it deals with Kyle Richards and a swing set and on a playground. I thought that entire sequence was great.
Interesting. Don't go any more detail on it, but they did release like a big part of that in like a trailer.
Great scene.
And I thought it was going to be the opposite. I was like, that kind of feels out of place, but in the trailer kind of thing. So that's, I'm glad to hear that it's actually great.
And if you're a Halloween fan, that scene itself is a callback to the 78, but also there's some Easter eggs in that scene. I like that scene. That's the only scene that I think Lauren and I were talking about. Like that was a good scene. That was it.
All right. Let's get to the blend game. This week's blend game, to talk about Michael Myers and whether he's human or not, is getting into Supernatural. And Supernatural is kind of an open definition. You can go a couple different ways with it. We're playing hashtag Supernatural Movie Blend, and I'm going to start with Jake. Jake, where are you going with Supernatural Movie Blend?
Again, a huge portion of this is how you're interpreting that word. When I hear Supernatural, I kind of zero in on ghosts.
Okay.
Like, for me, it's less about possession. It's less about monsters. It's not just things outside of the realm of reality. From when it's super,
not
me,
just things that are supernatural.
Yeah, they're a little natural to paraphrase The Office. So I'm going with The Shining, because to me, there's no greater ghost story than The Shining, and for me, the Shining is a movie that doesn't just make me feel the fear that is intended to instill. It makes me feel seasons. Like, I feel like the cold, you know, whenever they're stuck in that blizzard in the Overlook Hotel. You know, I feel both isolation and claustrophobia at the same time. I feel a sense of disorientation, you know, because Kubrick's layout of the Overlook actually doesn't really make any sense. So this feeling of like turning a corner, not knowing what's going to be there. What's funny is, and I feel all of those things about that movie, and it has had such a massive impact on my life, and I've only ever seen it on television.
Yeah.
I've never seen it on the big screen before.
Right.
So
right.
For a movie to have that kind of power, watching it initially on like an old pan and scan TV on VHS, to watching it in 4K on my TV now, is a testament to the film itself and not the environment that I'm watching it in. So just everything about that film just takes me out of where I am. And usually where I am is a constant reminder that I'm tethered to reality. Usually I'm watching it in my living room. Mm-hmm. And so it's like being at a haunted house that's next door to a Taco Bell. Like you're kind of reminded, that you're still tethered to reality. And which case, outside the burbs of Chicago, a haunted house just opened up where you get picked up by a bus and driven out to the middle of the woods. And
nope.
That's what I'm talking about. Oh, nope. It's the greatest haunted house I've ever seen in my entire life. It's fantastic.
Nope.
In fact, it's built in an area in which your cell phone goes out whenever you go through, because it's built like around an old quarry. That's
nice.
Incredible. So that's kind of what it is. Like, despite the fact that I'm in a haunted house that's like on a freeway, I still feel like I'm sucked in. I still feel like I'm in the middle of the woods. I still feel like I'm in the middle of Colorado. So for me, it's The Shining.
All right, I'm going to go with my definition of supernatural being more so that it's a force that people are having a really hard time explaining what it is. There's no easy answer to it. It's not vampires. It's not a werewolf. So I guess from that perspective, you could look at demonic possession as, well, yes, it's Satan sort of thing. But my favorite parts of The Exorcist, which is my choice, are when the family cannot figure out what's going on with their daughter.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And you get to the part with the priests eventually, and
why
that's when
is she
the exorcism
peeing on the floor
kicks in. Right. But that is like one of the scariest parts, is when she comes down, into the party and And of course, when she twists herself into the pretzel and, you know, crab walks down, yeah. down the stairs. And just the idea, like, part of the reason why The Exorcist remains to be, like, I think you guys both say The Shining. I think The Exorcist is the scariest movie that I've ever seen in my life. And it's primarily because all of this is happening to a kid. And the, you know, you're powerless from, and this is way before I even became a parent, like, as the mother is so powerless to help her child, and the things that they did, you know, you can gloss over like, oh, this girl's, you know, having a hard time. But with The Exorcist, they like turned it up to 11, you know, of just like the horrific things that they did to this girl and made her do. So that was a great part of the conversation that we had with the guys who did Don't Breathe 2 about the crucifix and how scarring that was to them. So I love those elements of, because even in Insidious, horror movies like that to me are so much more interesting until the answer is given. You know, I love that element of what might it be? And even I mentioned Malignant. Malignant is really more interesting to me until we are told what it is. Mm. And then Malignant is cool because once we do know what it is, that's when James Wan is just like high gear, you know? But I love the tantalizing, you know, where you're throwing out guesses and trying to figure out what it is. And so, you know, in looking at them, I ended up going with The Exorcist. So, Kev, how do you define supernatural and where did you go?
I went Ghostbusters. I'll go ahead and plug that we have Ivan Reitman and Jason Reitman coming up on our show in a couple of weeks for Afterlife. There's something Jason who said it in the interview about Steven Spielberg leaning over to him and saying like the library scene is one of the great top 10 scares of all time. Ghostbusters is a horror film. like there, that movie is terrifying. If you look back on it, in terms of what was going on with those characters, like, and Sigourney Weaver's characters and the gargoyles, the dogs, the eyes. What's interesting about that film to me is that is like the definition of supernatural. Like it is like them getting to the hotel and trying to figure out what's going on, what Slimer is, and like figuring out the technology and trying to capture the ghost. And like, there's just something so special and unique about that. But at the same time, it's such an immersive story that you're in it. It's like, that's the world. Like the Ghostbusters, it's like, we can look back on it now and go, oh, that was fun for childhood nostalgia. It's a great film. Like, yeah. It's a really good movie that is well executed, and it could have been goofy. I mean, think about it. Four guys with these massive packs on their backs firing hand-drawn animated proton beams at these ghosts, and like how that even would even work comes down to having a great director and having a great storyteller, but also having great actors. And I think that's the beauty of Ghostbusters, is like there's this feeling when you have watching Ghostbusters that like there's a sense of when I watch it, I feel the supernatural sense the whole movie. I feel like wind going by me, like there's something in a room at every moment, and like the score, the music, just the way like the goo will drip down from like the library cards or whatever. There's just something
it's all
about
practical.
It.
It's practical.
It's
effects.
So interesting. But it was Ghostbusters is like I think it's a scarier film than we give it credit for. To be honest with you, I think it's actually a really scary film. But I think as kids, it was fun because it was the proton pack stuff. But that was like my introduction into like my fascination with supernatural elements in films. Like I just really felt like that movie was special in that sense. And I think to this day, that's my favorite one. That's the one I go to.
In doing a lot of research for our Reitman interview, I watched a bunch of old interviews with Ivan where he talked about Ghostbusters during the 1980s being the Ronald Reagan era, and how it was significant because the villain of the film was more the Environmental Protection Agency, and how the EPA wanted to shut the Ghostbusters
down. Oh, I can't do this villain
shut the Ghostbusters down. What's that?
I can't do this, like, who's the real villain conversation with
you. Oh, no. I'm just, no. There was definitely ghosts and villains. Yeah. But, you know, there was that character, yes. Walter Peck, you know, and he was the one
the
who
word
was
you guys are looking
odds.
For is antagonist. There can be Thank several you. People who antagonize
Thank
our
you.
Protagonists.
He was an antagonist. One of the conversations I wanted to have with Ivan, too, that before we just ran out of time, is he made movies during a time when the actors were the draw, you know? Yeah. And I would have loved to, because you guys don't remember this, I'm the old one in the crew, but when people went to go see Ghostbusters, they were going to go see the new Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd movie.
Yeah.
The SNL
it wasn't,
guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah
it
yeah.
absolutely yeah. was not, we're going to see Ghostbusters. And even like Stripes and Ghostbusters, they were just like, they were described as, oh, it's Bill Murray in the military. Mm. Oh, this is Bill Murray with ghosts. You know, yeah. like you didn't know what the franchise was. And so now with Jason having to operate in this realm where we only deal in franchises and IP, and it almost doesn't matter who the person is in it. I would have loved to get the dynamic of Ivan sort of, you know, helming films like that.
So. I do really miss that era. Like I do. Yeah. There's something I love about a pitch of like, this is Eddie Murphy, but it's he's in this situation. You know, like,
on an island.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such a fun, like, it's such an easy sell. It's easy to get you excited. And
I think, I mean, we talk about this a lot. Like, Arnold is probably one of the last ones that you did, you got that with. It was it's Arnold as fill in the blank.
Right.
Arnold in this movie, done. Arnold as a pregnant person, Junior, done. I'm going. Like it was
Arnold
like,
Schwarzenegger is a kindergarten cop in the film. Yes. Kindergarten cop.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in. But you're so right. Also, I want to say, like, we've been doing this show for a few years now. There was something magical the other day, seeing Jason Reitman and Ivan Reitman sitting together,
mm-hmm.
talking about generationally what those films meant, and it was just like I get teary eyed thinking about it. It was like I'm like. This is incredible. Like, how are we talking to Ivan and Jason Reitman at the same time about a Ghostbusters movie?
Right.
And we could ask them anything we wanted about Ghostbusters.
I know.
And it was truly like, I can't wait for people to hear that interview. It's such a special interview that we got. And like, it meant so much to me emotionally to talk to both of them about it because it's so interesting.
There's an element to where I'm going to say when we're able to release it, we're going to release it closer to the movie's release. Try to go out of your way to watch the YouTube video because there are moments when Ivan is telling like long stories about working on Ghostbusters or Ghostbusters 2. And I look at all three of our faces and we are all just like so like we can't
believe but to devastate yeah. even so Jason like was enamored with a lot of these stories.
Yeah, Jason took over a Real Blend and asked a question.
He did
like there like he literally became a host and asked his like he asked his dad a question that he could have asked him at any point in his entire life. But he decided that was the moment. Oh, I want to ask my dad this real fast. Hold on, guys, real quick. And it's like, what just happened? It was cool.
It was great. All right, audience picks back to Supernatural Blend. So Amanda Young went with Poltergeist, classic.
Oh, great answer.
Patrick Knight went with The Frighteners, Peter Jackson's film.
I love that movie.
It's terrific.
Great. Who said that?
Patrick Knight said The Frighteners.
Patrick, that's a great choice. That is a classic Peter Jackson film pre-LOTR time period. Like, by the way, go back and watch his other stuff like Dead Alive and Bad Taste.
It's
and
so funny that
Feebles.
You said it because the other day I would jump to all the streaming services and just search Peter Jackson because I wanted to watch some of his earlier films and none of them are available.
Well, they're so
it's just like, Lord of the Rings. It's Sean's hell. Yeah. It's just Lord of the Rings.
King Kong.
If one person hears this,
the Lonely Bones.
Watch Dead Alive.
Lonely Bones. Oh, Lonely sounds better.
The Lonely
Dead Alive.
Yeah, it's great.
There's a wait. Can I just say one thing? There's a scene in Dead Alive. It's a zombie film. This guy takes a lawnmower, picks it up, turns it on, and walks into a crowd of zombies and just slices them all up. And it is just awesome. It's so awesome.
Speaking of awesome ways to get rid of somebody, Christian Hestis went with Hereditary. Easily one of the most shocking scenes I've ever seen in my entire life. Y'all know which one I'm talking about. Yeah. It involves a pole. William says What Lies Beneath, and Eric Carter said Dr. Sleep. It's a masterpiece. Listen, anything Flanagan, obviously. I think Flanagan deals in the supernatural. I think we could all obviously talk about Hill House or Bly Manor or the brilliant Midnight Mass.
What Lies Beneath?
What Lies Beneath is a really good one as well.
Underrated too. Zemeckis, by the way. Yep.
That is terrific. For next week. Oh, Jesus, Gabe. You gotta be kidding me.
Hey, the time has come. It's unavoidable.
It's, go on to social media and use hashtag Denis Villeneuve. Hashtag Denis Villeneuve blend.
I know.
That's not fair, Gabe.
Are you gonna also...
that's not really a nice thing to do.
I mean, how?
I can't. How do you pick?
How do you do? Yeah, all right. So let us know your picks on social media or via email at realblend@cinemablend.com. That's going to be an interesting, interesting conversation.
And we're going to have Denis Villeneuve on our show next week.
Yes, sir.
As a guest on the show. That's insane.
And it happened.
I was like, hashtag it happened.
It happened a long time ago. I can't believe Dune's not out yet.
when we finished that interview, Sean said, like, and he's so right, it was like a religious experience. Like,
it really
was. Like, it was, if when you see Dune, even if you haven't seen Dune and you hear the interview, it's, you're hearing from one of the greatest to ever
update for anyone who cares, because I've been giving you guys crap about seeing it. I'm finally seeing it tomorrow morning.
Yay!
And out of all of us, Gabe is the biggest Dune fan, and sure. Gabe has been so... Gabe's excitement for Dune is kind of, aside from the Denis element, was one of the big reasons why I was excited to see it, too. I when we do our show next week, I want Gabe to spend a good section reviewing it. He knows the book so well.
So we're finally at the point where Gabe can say he's watching it soon.
Dune,
but spelled U-N-E. That was more of a written joke that you had there.
Probably. All right. The review this week comes from Michael Joseph, who writes, "Hi, gents. I've been considering writing a review for a while now, and I finally decided to pull the trigger, so here goes. What sets the Real Blend podcast apart from other film-related podcasts is the sense of genuine love, respect, and camaraderie between the hosts." Should see us outside of the show. No, I'm only kidding. "I should step back a bit and admit that I listen to a ton of film-related podcasts. Working from home these days can be lonely, so I always have a podcast playing in the background for company. While some of these podcasts have been around for longer, or are perhaps an offshoot of a larger concern, the only one I find myself coming back to repeatedly, even once I have finished an episode, is Real Blend. I put this down to the friendship and palpable love of film that comes through from the hosts. Basically, I just like to hear these dudes shooting the shit about their mutual passion. I have to be honest and admit that I don't always agree with them." That's not a surprise. "Hell, I sometimes find myself shouting a correction or a contrary opinion at my Alexa device like a crazy person. Listening to Sean, Jake, Kevin, and Gabe geek out about a piece of news or get into the minutiae of box office numbers really feels like I'm hanging out with my own buddies, or at least folks that I can get behind. There's also something else to be said for positive energy, and I find the show refreshing in that it is never mean-spirited. There is no joy in taking apart a bad film. I mean, sure, sometimes a film is bad, and it can be increasingly fun ripping it apart, but that's not the agenda of the show. It feels like the guys want to like every film, and that's unique in an age of cynicism and sarcasm. Basically, what I'm saying is, Real Blend is the Ted Lasso of podcasts." I put that on social media after I read that, because that is just one of the best compliments you could ever give us. He goes on to say, "In all seriousness, I continue listening to Real Blend, not just because the interview questions are incredibly well-reasoned and thought out, not just because it speaks to my passion, but because it is a truly wonderful feeling to know that there are people out there in the world who you just know in your soul are part of your tribe. Basically, what I'm getting at is, which one of you wants to adopt me? Keep up the good work." This is from Mike Joseph in Cape Town, South Africa.
Wow.
Michael, thank you so very much for that incredible
review.
Again, thank you for that amazing review. You guys can send us reviews at realblend@cinemablend.com. Gabe will make sure that they get them into the notes that we read each week on the show. Our next premium episode, which is dropping on Monday, is going to be for the 2008 Oscars in Review. You can get access to this and all the episodes of Real Blend Premium by going to cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. During the week, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and at Real Blend for the show. We're going to have Denis Villeneuve on next week's show. And
as one does.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. It's a special one, so tune in for that one. In the meantime, get your Spielberg picks ready. We'll talk to you all next week. I was going to say the Polar Express.
The Terminal!
Why on earth would I say the Polar Express?
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
The Terminal.
Munich!
Save big on brunch for Mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.